Welcome back to another episode of The Coolidge Connection. I'm Joanna McCool. This series explores the legacy of Calvin Coolidge by interviewing people connected to him or his family. In today's episode, I speak with Chris Jeter, a great-grandson of the former president. Like his cousins, Jennifer Coolidge Harville and John Sayles, Mr. Jeter has a deep connection to the family land of Plymouth Notch, Vermont, which is one of the themes he discusses in this episode. He also recalls memories with his grandparents, John and Florence Coolidge, shares special details about Calvin Coolidge, and draws parallels between his life and the past. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy. May you please introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about how you're connected to Calvin Coolidge.
Sure. I'm Christopher Coolidge Jeter, great-grandson of President Calvin Coolidge. Calvin and Grace Coolidge had two boys, John and Calvin Jr. Unfortunately, Calvin Jr. passed away at the age of 16 from blood poisoning. And John went on to marry Florence Trumbull. They had two daughters, Cynthia, my mother, and Lydia. Unfortunately, both daughters have passed away, and I was the only child of Cynthia and Edward Jeter. And Lydia went on to marry Jerry Sayles, and they had two children, Jenny and John.
How has your life been shaped by this connection to Calvin Coolidge?
I'd say just an emphasis on character and moral values, things like that. I was quite close with my grandfather, so I tried to follow his example.
Were there any things that you learned from him in terms of character and life?
Probably more essence of things and not necessarily specific lessons, so to speak, that he would lay out. Certainly his father, as well as my grandfather, there are people that would tend to lead by example as opposed to getting up at a podium and preaching it. So nothing in particular comes to mind. It's more a way of how one conducts themselves in certain situations, things like that.
Were you ever treated differently because of your relationship to Calvin Coolidge?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'd say yes and no. And it's really mostly no, but I answer the yes side first. As far as being who I am and related to President Coolidge, I marched to the cemetery on July 4th, commemorating Coolidge's birthday and other events, and get to meet notable people through Coolidge Foundation events, things like that. But the no, how I'm not treated differently is really the other 95% of my time, if you will, is where I'm just Chris Jeter from Connecticut, because it's not something that really comes up and certainly nothing I wear on my sleeve in terms of my connection to President Coolidge. Certainly proud of it, but not something that I advertise. So my middle name is Coolidge, not my last name. I fly a little bit lower under the radar than my grandfather did because of not only being his son, but the last name, or even my mother and my aunt Lydia with their last name being Coolidge until they were married. It was a little more obvious of a connection.
Do you have any unique experiences or stories that happened to you because of your relationship to Coolidge?
Probably a few. One thing I certainly recall, in the 80s, my parents and I toured the White House and got to meet with Nancy Reagan. So that was memorable. And after that, got to speak at the JFK Library in Boston as part of a symposium conducted by the Coolidge Foundation celebrating the 75th anniversary of Coolidge becoming president. So that was a special experience. But otherwise, those are the two events that come most readily to mind. Like I say, it's not as though it's any kind of celebrity lifestyle.
Going back to the other question, you said Lydia and Cynthia having the last name of Coolidge might have gotten more attention. Do you know any stories about them, if anything happened to them because of their relationship to Calvin Coolidge?
What's difficult and unfortunate is they both passed away in middle age. So there's less time for them to share stories once their kids were adult age for both families. So there may have been more stories that we didn't get to hear. But one thing that I do recall, and I think I recall my Aunt Lydia telling it more than my mother, but I don't know at what point in school they were. It certainly was in college, but it was either maybe high school or grade school at some level. They would sort of cringe when there'd be times And again, I don't know the details about if they sometimes took the bus versus being dropped off at school, but once in a while, occasions where they'd be dropped off at school and they there was apparently a driver. And so their preference was to be dropped off a block away from school and walk there versus having to be seen getting out of the car without their parents. It was the driver dropping them off. So they themselves trying to keep a lower profile.
And is that because Florence couldn't drive, if I'm remembering correctly?
I suppose, to tell you the truth, I'm thinking she might have driven early in her life, because I remember a story about her having a car that had, I think it was orange leather upholstery. The Trumbulls were a little more flamboyant than the Coolidges, if you will. I think the next one is the earliest memories of John and Florence.
Yes. Can you share some of your memories with them?
Sure. Probably as a young child, before going to elementary school, I recall my mother would drop me off at my grandparents while she went grocery shopping once a week or so. They had a house in Farmington, Connecticut, which was the town next to where I grew up. So there was fairly frequent interaction between the families there, of course, in addition to Plymouth.
Do you have any funny stories you would like to share about them?
My cousins, Jenny and John, have mentioned some of them in previous episodes of this series. But one thing I recall is in the mid-80s, I think, there was a remembrance get-together in the church in Plymouth of the people in Plymouth and the area there. And it wasn't necessarily just focused on Coolidge. It was more stories about old-time Plymouth. And I was there with my grandparents, and it was just neat, some of the old-timers, to hear them tell stories. But again, it wasn't all Coolidge-related, but I got my grandfather to tell a great story about the housekeeper at the homestead. Her name was Aurora Pierce. So she was just a classic flinty New Englander, as I would describe her. And I could go on and tell some stories about how she'd make a loaf of bread last longer than anybody. Like, basically, it was rock hard stale, and she'd find ways to continue to use it. And she had some excess cash for safekeeping. She would stitch inside the lining of her jacket or something, little spots for bills. She would keep some of her cash in the lining of her outer garments so that no one would find it or anything. And just funny things like that. And then the story I had my grandfather tell, I kind of nudged him during this thing at the church. I'm like, come on, Grandpa, you gotta tell a story about Aurora, because he had said it, his downfall, as he had mentioned at the dinner table a year or two earlier, and I'd remembered it. And so I wanted him to tell it again about Aurora when she would go to take her bath in the homestead. And in those days, as with any old home, those skeleton keys, you put them in the keyhole, but there's a keyhole, it's kind of like a little opening in the door. So she was concerned enough about her privacy, she would take newspaper and stuff it in the keyhole. But it was one of those things where my grandfather selling the homestead to the, giving it to the state to begin the historic site. Certainly he wasn't going to do it while Grace was alive, even though Grace didn't travel up there much, probably at all, in her final years, of course. But I'm not sure exactly when Aurora passed away, but it was also one of those things where, well, that was Aurora's house, you know, the housekeeper. And so don't be messing with Aurora's house while she's around. So another thing I recall is we'd go out to dinner, and it wasn't just one particular time. It was pretty much just about every time, a little bit of a routine. So we'd go out to dinner, and my grandmother and grandfather, but really more my grandmother, was very particular about where we could go, because most places were either too loud or maybe not private enough. So there was a handful of places that we'd go out to. When we'd go out to dinner, we pretty much knew where we were going. It was a few places that we'd always go to. But anyway, we'd order our meal, and nearly every time the main entree would come out, she'd exclaim, "Wow, that's a big portion," and she'd eat some of it. But when dessert was presented, of course, she'd pick what dessert she wanted, and so she'd exclaim, "Oh, yummy," and proceed to eat all of it. So she had a sweet tooth. So that was kind of the out-to-dinner routine with her in terms of a little funny thing here. Another minor thing, I'm on the food topic, is my grandfather liked peanuts, or really any kind of nuts, as his father did. And it was just something that if he was over at our house, if we were over at their house for something, for hors d'oeuvres, so to speak, you might have some Plymouth cheese, but there'd also be nuts. And I also tie into that with his father, with President Coolidge, was that I recall watching a television miniseries called Backstairs at the White House. It was actually quite good. I think it was in 79 or early 80s, late 70s. So one minor point I recall from that segment on Coolidge was that President Coolidge liked to have bowls of nuts placed around the White House. So apparently Coolidge enjoyed nuts as well as my grandfather, and that very well may be where my grandfather got it from. It's funny. It's kind of like a little bit like my grandfather, and I think a little bit like Coolidge, president, in that you get me going on a topic and it's something of interest, I'll keep going. And like, such a chatterbox, he won't stop. Somebody would be like, well, I mean, Chris Jeter, he's quiet as a mouse. He never says anything. But if you were to come up to me and we didn't really know each other, or in like a cocktail party situation, oh, how you doing? Good. The weather's nice. Yeah. And that would be about it. I think Coolidge, the president, was that way. And my grandfather was just not big on small talk. You may have heard the story where, I think it was in the homestead, because the way it was laid out, Calvin would tell the story. Maybe it's in his autobiography, about having to go through the door into the kitchen. So he would be off in some other part of the house and hear a guest or visitor come in and be sitting stereotypically at the kitchen table or whatever, talking with his parents. And he'd have to go through that kitchen door and say hello to whoever it was. And he'd have this trepidation of, you could hear the person and like, do I really have to go in there? And I guess I do. So like going through the kitchen door and saying hello and all, like not really wanting to get into a conversation with someone if you didn't really have to.
Do you have any special memories of your grandparents that you would like to share?
Sure. And one of my favorite stories that I've told fairly often, so I may be telling it too often, I'll have to find another favorite. But anyway, one particular time, the 4th of July ceremony at the cemetery. And towards the end of the day, when it would be less active, we'd go over and trim around the headstones and tidy things up. So one year in particular, my grandfather and I were over there doing just that. And someone happened to stop by and looking around and casually commented to us that it must be quite an honor to care for a presidential gravesite. At which point my grandfather and I looked at each other. And my grandfather just simply replied, yes, it is. And then he and I put our heads down and kept on working. That was always a classic Coolidge brevity and not really getting into who we happened to be, because, of course, then that would have probably carried on for a pretty lengthy conversation and we wouldn't have gotten what we needed to get done finished in time. So I always enjoyed that story. As my cousins have mentioned some of these things, but we'd always say grace before meals, not just in Plymouth, just everywhere with my grandparents. So we'd say grace before meals, the business about waving goodbye when they're up in Plymouth and we'd be driving down the long driveway and then down the road. It was kind of open fields, so you could see for a fair distance. And so the whole routine would be, you'd be waving goodbye to them from the car and they'd be up on the porch of the house waving. And you're supposed to keep waving until you couldn't see them anymore. And then there's times when the arm might be freezing out the window, but you still kept waving. And so usually when I was younger, obviously in the back seat, I'd be looking ahead and as we're approaching into the center of Plymouth Notch there, and I'd be thinking, these people are going to be thinking we're waving at them as we start coming into town. So that was just sort of a family tradition. Another thing I can certainly remember is working at the homestead with Liza Hoskison when I was a little guy, probably elementary school age. I would walk across the fields from the house to where my grandparents lived, up on a knoll to the homestead, and assist Liza, who was the interpreter back in those days. There was a person who was in each of the buildings to welcome the tourists as they came through the site and into each building and tell them a little bit about it. And then they'd go through the rest of the homestead. It's almost like a maze that they go through with glass windows to look into the different rooms as they were left untouched at the time the Coolidges lived there. But Liza Hoskison, John Dunville mentioned, and I didn't realize that she was considered sort of the site administrator way back in the very early days. To me, she was always somebody who was one of the people working at the site. But I think before my time, she may have had a larger role at the site, and I just was unaware of that. So I would help her out at the homestead and punch tickets and answer questions and clean up after closing time each day, going around with the Windex and paper towels and cleaning off the fingerprints on all the glass windows that people would point at and look through. So when I first started working there and helping her out, I'd been told previously the story of my Aunt Lydia accepting money from someone, taking her picture as a child in Plymouth, and I knew that was a no-no. So I kind of took it to an extreme with Liza would try to pay me at the end of the day, just a token payment of 50 cents or a dollar for helping her out. And I'd say, oh, no, thank you. And so we went through that a few days. She was, I'm sure, trying to figure out what on earth, why wouldn't I accept money for it? She said, is it because you don't accept money from strangers? And I'm like, no. And she says, I'm not a stranger. No. And I didn't really want to tell the story, but Eventually, it got sorted out. So then I was comfortable taking her token payment from all my efforts helping her out. Anyway, that was kind of a funny thing. Another thing I recall about my grandfather is he always drove a large Chevrolet station wagon. He could have had any car he wanted, but car after car after car was always Chevrolet station wagon, probably the largest one they had. And the main purpose of that was so that when he traveled back and forth from Connecticut to Vermont, they'd have enough room in there because they'd come up to Vermont for the whole summer and then go back to Farmington, Connecticut in the fall. Later years, I'd help drive them back and forth. So that was sort of a little routine we did. But his comment years back would have been that he needed the large station wagon because he would load it up with firewood, maple syrup, and Plymouth cheese to be able to bring it down to Connecticut with him for use down there. And in fact, another little related story is that there was a number of cords of wood in the basement of the house they had in Plymouth, which apparently was the rent paid for by the farmer living in the farmhouse. And that's the President Coolidge's, where his grandparents lived. So later years, there was a farmer that rented it, and apparently the rent payment was providing firewood for my grandparents. So there's quite a collection of firewood because certainly they didn't burn it as quickly as the farmer was supplying it, put it that way. Liza Hoskinson, her husband was this fellow Charles Hoskinson. He held a number of different offices in town. He was a justice of the peace and would marry people, but he was a classic New England farmer. And he and Liza were the ones that lived in the farmhouse for decades. So that farmhouse I mentioned, built in 1802 or something like that, we don't know exactly the year. That was actually, if I've got it right, built by not Calvin President's grandparents, but actually his great-grandparents. And then it was his grandparents that were living there when Calvin was alive and a young boy and all that. But there was a generation before them that built the farmhouse. After Calvin's grandparents passed away, I'm not sure if the house was vacant for very long, but then the Hoskinsons, Liza and Charles, moved into the farmhouse and rented it from my grandparents for decades. And so he was the one that would supply the firewood as rent for the farmhouse. And he had some cows because there's a large barn adjacent to the farmhouse. Small scale dairy operation, if you will. And so when I came along, I'd spend time with him. And he would take me, we would drive down old roads and places where I didn't even think we could get through, in like almost the woods, to show me old cellar holes and all, because he knew everything. And so he was like a classic old timer. And then one last thing I'll mention is my grandfather's final years. Fortunately, he got to see my son, Kyle, who was my oldest son, when he was just a little guy. I think Kyle was 3 years old when my grandfather passed away. So at least he was able to see one of his great-grandchildren. Kyle and my grandfather would get a kick out of Kyle, let's say, when he was 2 years old or something. He had this little plastic hammer and a wrench and, you know, little tools. And so at that point, my grandfather, in his final years, is in a wheelchair. And so Kyle would come over to the wheelchair and start working on the wheel and the spokes and the axle and things like that, trying to make sure it was all in good working order. And so my grandfather would get a big kick out of that.
As an adult looking back on their lives and your time with them, what about your grandparents stands out to you? What do you admire and respect about them?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is just how my grandfather never sought the spotlight. And I sort of knew it when he was alive, but since he passed on, even past year or two, I'll have people in Plymouth tell me about how that was his thing, was that, oh no, you don't call him Mr. Coolidge. He doesn't care for that. You just call him John or Mr. C because he wanted to keep a low profile. And I'm sure early on, years and years back, that people would refer to him as Mr. Coolidge. And then suddenly anybody that was touring the site, suddenly, you know, my grandfather couldn't get out of there for half an hour. He preferred to keep a low profile. That was neat. And just humility and being humble, things like that were great characteristics. He had a great sense of humor, which came out every once in a while. He was not a jokester or openly humorous, if you will, but every so often the dry wit would come out, and it was quite funny when it did. But he was mostly quiet and didn't talk about his time in Washington much. But I always enjoyed spending time with my village grandparents. As I grew older, I'd occasionally think about the future, especially after my mother passed away. I'd think about the future when my grandparents wouldn't be around and how on earth I was going to remember all the things that they knew, which would be next to impossible. But I tried to be as much of a sponge as I could. And a little bit later, after my grandmother passed away and my grandfather, John Coolidge, survived her by a few years before she passed, they would still divide their time between Plymouth, Vermont, and Connecticut. And so when she passed away, my grandfather took the opportunity to live in Vermont full time, something that he was very proud of. And he was able to spend the last couple of years living in Plymouth year round, assisted by his younger daughter, Lydia, and her husband, Jerry, and healthcare aides as needed. But he was always excited to proclaim that he was a Vermont resident. And that was his big emphasis. So he enjoyed being able to do that in his final years.
Can you talk a little bit more about the family connection to Plymouth? Because I think John didn't grow up there. And then it sounds like he lived in Connecticut for most of his adult years. So can you talk a little bit more about Plymouth Notch and the family connection there?
Sure. I'm trying to put it in terms perhaps that he would think of it as, but I know even myself where you just feel whether or not it's the longstanding family history between the Coolidge family and Plymouth, or for whatever reason, it's just a great spot and keeps drawing you back to it. He spent his adult life in Connecticut for the most part, as well actually as President Coolidge. He grew up in Plymouth, but his adult life was spent in Massachusetts for the most part, aside from obviously when he was president and vice president. But otherwise, he was in Massachusetts and would visit Plymouth when he could. So in some respects, really, my grandfather did the same thing as far as coming up there in the summertime, because he worked for the railroad for a number of years in Connecticut, but would always come up to Plymouth as much as he could. And of course, once he had more availability to do that, that's when they'd spend the whole summer up there. And then even earlier on, they would come up around New Year's and spend a few weeks, usually I think after Christmas, but around New Year's, they'd be up for a couple weeks in that time of year as well. So I think it's just the connection, because actually it goes back. I'm proud that I'm the eighth generation of Coolidges on land in Plymouth. And down the road, when my two boys have kids, their kids, so my grandkids, will be the 10th generation of Coolidges. And so that's pretty neat. And in fact, a farmhouse I mentioned where Calvin's grandparents lived, that was built in very early 1800s, 1802, 1803, and it's still in the family. I still maintain that today. So it's hard to walk away from longevity like that. Want to see it continue. Put it this way, when you do get the chance to see Plymouth, you'll probably get a little sense of how it's just a unique, special place. And of course, each person has their own opinions. And as much as I've, not that I've traveled all over by any means, but even for a place like Hawaii, like, oh, it's incredible and it's beautiful and all that. But if I had to pick, I'd pick Plymouth. But it's a very special place. And that's, I think, was part of my connection with my grandfather. It's just one of those things you can't really put your finger on.
It sounds like a very special place.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's great with all the different seasons. It's a different view, so to speak, each time you're there, if you're there in the different seasons throughout the year. But it's just a neat spot.
Can you talk a little bit more about what John Coolidge did as a working adult? You mentioned he worked for the railroads.
I'll try to do it justice. However, I feel as though I don't really know of all the particulars, but it was always referred to as an executive with the New Haven Railroad. They lived in Orange, Connecticut. That's where they lived when both my mother and I believe Lydia were born. They were in Orange, Connecticut. But anyway, he worked with the railroad, and I'm not sure exactly what he did there. I don't think it was necessarily always just a desk job, so to speak, in one place. I think he did some traveling on the trains, but I really don't know exactly, unfortunately. And then I believe after that, he went on to start a company with his father-in-law, so John Trumbull, Lawrence's father, before he was governor, called Converters. And that was a company that made office envelopes, paper sort of products, if you will. So he ran that company for a number of years. And he was on the boards of some a local bank and a hospital and things like that. That was really his working life, as far as I know it. I'm sure I'm skipping certain things. And he was involved in various charitable organizations and things like that. Salvation Army was one of them, as well as he was the one that started up after it had been dormant for several decades, the Plymouth Cheese Factory, which his grandfather had started, Calvin Coolidge's father. So that was something that he was involved in, certainly when he was up in Plymouth, but of course, the business didn't stop when he was away in the wintertime. So he would be on the phone and dealing with paperwork from up there and things like that. So He kept it active, but a little bit different than what one might think of as a typical job nowadays, as far as working for a large company and going to the same desk all the time.
Did John ever talk about the presidency or his time in the White House?
No, not too much about it, like I mentioned earlier, but there are a few recollections that, as I've been thinking more about it, that I recall him mentioning. Of course, as far as the White House goes, just to make it clear to folks, that he never really lived there himself. He was away at Amherst College, just I think beginning his time at Amherst when Coolidge became president. So he would come to visit his parents at the White House on school vacations. I think he was away at camp for part of the summers, so he didn't really ever spend any lengthy time there. But I do recall him mentioning that one occasion when he was at the White House, he managed to get up into the White House attic and saw the charred timbers from the War of 1812 when the White House was set on fire, which was pretty amazing to hear that story. And who knows by now if that's been all completely redone, so there's no signs of that. But to think that in the 1920s, there are still signs of the fire from the early 1800s is pretty remarkable. But I think as far as his time in the White House and his interaction with his parents, especially his father, was difficult for him at times. In fact, I recently came across a newspaper article from the 20s, which said that after Calvin Jr.'s death, that John was under extra scrutiny by his father, which kind of makes sense as far as you think from a parent's perspective. If one of your two children passes away at the ripe age of 16, you're going to be extra protective of the surviving child, as well as, unfortunately, for whatever reasons, Calvin Coolidge wrote in his autobiography that he blamed himself for Calvin Jr.'s death in a kind of a twisted way, that he thought if he wasn't president, then they would not have been playing tennis on the White House lawn, and the blood blister would not have developed on Calvin's foot. And that's how it happened. John and Calvin were playing tennis, and Calvin Jr. decided he didn't have time to put on socks, and so he was playing tennis without socks on in his shoes. And that's how the blood blister developed. So unfortunately, it's sort of a harsh way for Calvin the president to look at it that way, but just the way he felt. So I can imagine having another sibling and losing them that young, because my grandfather would have been just 18 or so when Calvin Jr. passed away. So that's a tough thing to go through. And then incidentally, there's a kind of a connection to the present in some ways. When I was 16, I was working for a landscaping company in the summer, and I developed blood poisoning. I got a tiny little nick sort of on the cuticle of my finger and didn't think much of it. And then during the course of the following day, just could tell I wasn't feeling right and went to the doctor, and it turned out that I had blood poisoning. So I was thankful that penicillin had been discovered since Calvin's time, but it was kind of eerie that I was 16 when it happened. There's another, as far as the White House years for my grandfather, later on in Calvin Coolidge's presidency, there was a story, and John Dumville mentioned part of it, but I'm just going to elaborate a little further on it, about the story of John and Florence meeting on the train. It's a great story, and it was helpful to hearing John Dumville tell it because it brought back details that I might not have otherwise remembered. As I mentioned at the beginning of Coolidge's tenure as president, John, his son, was off at Amherst College, and because his father was president, he had a Secret Service man that stayed with him in his dorm and everything. So he was always had a shadow with him, so to speak. And the Secret Service's man's name was Woody. And so Woody was pretty much always around with my grandfather. I think there's some little incidental stories or things where Woody, to give my grandfather some privacy, would disappear a little bit from time to time, but of course, it was never too far away. But anyway, one time when my grandfather was, I guess, coming back from Amherst, going down to Washington on the train, because that was the major form of travel. And I believe, if I've got this part of the story correct, when you're on the train coming either down from Hartford or from the Massachusetts area, from, let's say, Amherst, you get down to New Haven and they switch the locomotives because they switch from diesel to electric because it's electrified going into New York City. So I'm imagining it was there, but it could have been somewhere along my grandfather's trip on the train. They stop and word comes through, as my grandfather tells the story. And word came through that a car carrying the governor of Connecticut had been added to the train. And so John is sitting there with his Secret Service man, Woody, and they're traveling along. And my grandfather's thinking to himself, you know, it's the governor of Connecticut on this train. And assuming they're heading to Washington, I really ought to get up and pay him my respects just to have the courtesy to do that, knowing that he's there. So he got up from his seat and started to walk through the train to get to the car that the governor was in. And we got to the doorway. If you've ever been on a train, you know, you walk from car to car and there's these doorways between them. So he gets to the doorway of the governor's car and the security person at the door didn't want to let him in. And of course, my grandfather wasn't really going to say exactly who he was. So, okay. So he comes back to his seat and sits down and thinks more about it and says, you know, Woody, I really ought to pay my respects to the governor of Connecticut. So Woody, would you go down and tell that policeman or whoever it was that who I am and to let me through? That got arranged. So then my grandfather walks back down there to pay his regards to the governor of Connecticut, gets through the doorway. And so the door opens up and my grandfather thought he knew the governor of Connecticut. He looks into the eyes of a complete stranger. So he had that kind of uncomfortableness of paying his regards to somebody who he thought he knew, but he had no idea. He thought he knew the governor, but apparently he didn't. And apparently in the governor's car, traveling with the governor, were his two daughters, grandmother Florence and her sister Jean. And so that was the, if you will, the first meeting of the two, completely accidentally. And the rest was history, as they say.
So did John share any other family stories, either about Calvin or Grace or his brother?
Well, as far as stories, thinking actually from Calvin and Grace's perspective of them and generations coming after them, that Calvin, the president, passed away before my mother was born. She was the older daughter of my grandparents. So unfortunately, he never got to see grandchildren, but certainly Grace did. And my mother had fond memories of Grace, and they would go and visit her when she lived in Northampton. And she moved out of the house where Calvin actually passed away and was known as the Beaches. That's where they moved. Calvin and Grace were still living in the duplex on Massasoit Street, Northampton, all the time that he was president. That was still their home outside of Washington. But then they, for obvious reasons, quickly found when they came back from Washington after the end of his presidential career that it was hard for them to live in a duplex in Northampton without people peering through the windows. So then they moved to a more private location in Northampton, and it's referred to as the Beaches. And that's where he passed away. And then after President Coolidge passed away, then Grace moved to more of a place of her own, so to speak, called Road Forks in Northampton. So that's where John and Florence and their two daughters would visit Grace. And so my mom had fond memories of that. And then once in a while, when they would visit, John and Florence might leave their daughters with Grace. And the instructions were always that she was not to spoil them. The joke was that almost as soon as my grandparents were out of sight, Grace would start making plans with Cynthia and Lydia to go out to go shopping or do something like that. So they always seemed to have a good time with each other. Another story, I guess, preceding that would have been the wedding of my grandparents, John and Florence, in Plainville, Connecticut. And that was apparently quite an event because the wedding was held on September 29th, 1929. And I looked it up to make sure I was correct in my recollection, and it was. That was a Monday. And the whole story was that they purposely held it on a Monday rather than on a weekend because they're trying to reduce the crowds. And still people climbed up in trees to catch a glimpse of the couple, and it was quite the occasion because if you think about it, Calvin Coolidge had just left the presidency earlier that year, and Governor Trumbull was still the current governor of Connecticut. So it was a bit of a big deal. But I think that's probably all the recollections I have for now.
Thank you so much for sharing your time.
Yes, thank you. And I actually do want to close with mentioning that it's so good to see the state of Vermont doing such a nice job maintaining and interpreting the historic site in Plymouth, Vermont, as well as the Coolidge Foundation continuing to do such great things with debate, the Coolidge Scholarship, plus many other areas. Back when I was your age, the foundation was operating on a card table in the basement of the church, you know, and it's just so different. And then the collaboration and partnership between the state and the foundation is sort of the icing on the cake. It's great to see how things have continued into the modern era. Well, again, thank you for all your efforts, not only with me, but with the foundation as a whole. We appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us here at the Coolidge Connection. This series is brought to you by the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, which is dedicated to preserving the memory and legacy of America's 30th president through various resources such as our Debate League, Scholarship Award, and our new virtual library. To learn more about the Coolidge Foundation and get involved, please visit us online at coolidgefoundation.org. We hope you will join us in our mission to spread timeless Coolidge values across the country. A very special thank you goes to Chris Jeter, who shared his time and stories with us today. We look forward to sharing another Coolidge Connection with you soon.